Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Blazing Light, a reverse harem paranormal romance by Chloe Adler, narrated by Alexander Sendes and Carly Robbins.
Thorn.
As the demon and I fall through the portal, I have time to ponder how this space could be utterly devoid of light. Even my keen eyesight picks up nothing, not a pinprick, not a shade of gray. One minute I was on the beach, following my cousin Nolan. My biggest decision as a small dragon the size of a house cat was which tasty insect to stalk and munch on. But then the sea parted, and this red-eyed horned beast from another world tried to intimidate Nolan into giving up our girl. He didn't. I'm proud of his refusal, though I would have clawed out his eyes if he'd given the demon any other answer. When the demon reached for him, I acted on instinct, and apparently so did it, pulling me into its world. After moments in free fall, I pull my claws free of its hold, and I spread my wings to break my fall, still sailing downward but as far from the demon as I can get. Flying around in a vacuum is less than ideal, and the smell. My snout picks up only char and decay. I breathe out fire to light my way, but it illuminates nothing beyond the outline of my wings in the darkness. After what is probably only moments, but feels like an eternity, my feet hit the ground, except it breaks apart under my talons like dried leaves. I bend down to inhale and wish I hadn't. Immediately I sneeze and cough, trying to drive the thick and foul stench from my throat.
"What's that?"
comes a tiny little voice to one side.
"A beast from another dimension,"
says another, a little more nasal than the first. They sound like damn smurfs. I can't distinguish their gender, not that it matters. Unfortunately, I can't speak, and I still can't see, so I stay put. If they try and hurt me, I can take flight, but if I step left or right, I might stomp one of them.
"Maybe it's come to save us."
I nod my head on the off chance they can see me.
"Did you see that? Was that a nod?"
I nod again. Sounds of crunching and crackling fill the air, which is as dense as jello. A tiny little hand touches the side of my neck.
"One nod for yes, and two for no,"
says the owner of the hand. I wait.
"Ah, this is where you test it, dunce,"
says the other with a sigh.
"Here, let me do it."
Another tiny hand touches the other side of my neck. I make sure to hold very still.
"Not twice for no,"
says the voice. I do.
"Now once for yes."
I nod once.
"It understands. Obviously. My name is Astra,"
says the first voice.
"And I'm Basil,"
says the nasal one. Great. I can't talk, so I merely nod.
"You came through a portal from the world beyond?"
asks Astra. I nod, tiring of this game.
"Well,"
says Basil,
"wherever you came from is far better than here."
"Yeah," says Astra on a sigh.
"Welcome to hell."
I stiffen. What the?
"Goodness, don't scare the guy."
He leans close to my ear.
"It's not really hell,"
she grunts.
"It is now, thanks to the scrim." "Shh, you trying to get yourself killed?" "The dragon will protect me,"
she pets the side of my neck.
"Won't you, boy?"
I find myself nodding. Any enemy of what I suspect is the demon who sent me here is a friend of mine, and though I can't see these creatures, their hands are so tiny, and their voices so high-pitched they must be about the size of the demon's middle finger.
"Yep, yep, compared to you, we are small,"
she says, as though she can read my thoughts.
"But the scrim used to be our size, too."
Her tiny hands smooth down my scales. The motion is soothing, hypnotic, and despite myself, I start to relax. I like these creatures. They're nice. She's petting me in just the right spot. My leg twitches and paws the air. Astra pulls her hand away, and I almost fall over, sucking in a deep breath to steady myself. I cough, practically shooting out a jet of fire.
"Careful,"
says Basil.
"It's not like he can scorch the ground anymore. But don't breathe too deeply,"
she says to me.
"That monster destroyed our world. There's nothing left but ash, and it sticks in your lungs. Causes ash lung,"
Basil adds.
And you don't want that.
She pats the side of my neck. Not if it feels anything close to what I'm already experiencing now, I don't.
You can say that again,
she says. Say what?
You'll help us write everything, won't you?
Astra purrs, stroking my neck again. Of course I will. Yes, yes, yes. I want to yell, but I nod furiously instead.
Our savior.
She plants a tiny kiss on my scales, and I beam. About time someone saw me as that. But wasn't I doing something in my own world? Don't I have family there? But that's silly. Astra and Basil are my family. No matter. I'm here with these two adorable, whatever they're called now, and this is where I shall stay.
We're pixies,
she says.
How rude of me not to ask for your name.
Thorn. Basil touches the other side of my neck.
Thorn, what a perfect name for you.
You can hear my thoughts?
Of course we can,
she giggles, the sound like wind chimes in a soft ocean breeze.
Here, we'll lead you to our house,
says Basil. Oh, yes, please.
He can't fit in our house, Basil. Oh,
he giggles.
Right, he's too big. He'll sleep outside and guard us.
Of course I will.
And in the morning, we'll teach him how to defeat the Skrim and bring back our light.
I'd do anything for you two.
Iphigenia. Rhys drives me to the circus for my performance. We hold hands, but neither of us speaks, as if he senses I need the time to center myself. I run through my routine in my head and try to push away the week's drama, but it seeps right back in. The good, the bad, and the delicious. I'm now a woman with three serious boyfriends. Nope, still sounds crazy. How do I even introduce everyone? I let out a small sigh. The important, wonderful thing is that all my men are happy with our arrangement, though I do wonder if everything will remain copacetic moving forward. I did just add Dominic to our mix, after all. As though he can read my mind, Rhys squeezes my hand. Little does he know that I'm the mind reader, but I trust Dominic not to spill the secret. I peer out the window, watching the trees give way to the ocean as we turn onto Discovery Highway. The moon is bright, lighting the water with a brilliance that can only be described as nature's magic.
Are you worried about your show, or are you thinking about the demon?
Rhys tightens his grip on my hand. Neither. Hopefully the demon is contained for now.
At least you've found a way to help those ghouls become human again. And the Signum.
His dark hair falls across his forehead, making him appear even more kissable. I lean over and peck his cheek when he turns back to the road. A broad smile creases his face. He's right. I should focus more on the positive and less on the drama. I was able to help some of those ghouls. Maybe I can stop the trauma in our town. Have you heard from your brother? I focus on his dark eyes, but they don't veer toward me or give any indication of how he's feeling. He shakes his head. No.
Nolan hasn't called me. At least Thorn is with him. I'm sure after a while he'll be fine. He used to go off like this when we were kids, too.
It must be difficult having a brother like that. Since they were recently reunited, Rhys has worked so hard to make Nolan feel like part of the family again. But he seems determined to remain alienated. Rhys turns into the boardwalk parking lot and stops the car. Leaning toward me, he pats his chest and I lunge into his embrace. His muscular arms wrap around me and hold me close, stroking the back of my head. I jerk away. No mussing the curls. How about a kiss? His eyes crinkle at the corners and I drop my lips on his. His mouth is wet and hot, the kiss intense. He gives me his full attention, leaning me back against the seat of the car and probing my mouth deeper. My answering kiss is ferocious. I need to cement my solo connection with Rhys. Last night when we made love, it was a foursome, and all my men were amazing. Rhys, Dominic, and Caspian played perfectly together with me as their focus. But now I crave time alone with each one. After everything we've been through over the past few weeks, I need to reconnect.
He stops kissing me to hold my gaze, and I clamber on top of him, straddling his legs and heaving myself against his rock-hard cock, grinding my wet core into his. I rock back, and his eyelids fall to half-mast. Let me. My breath is tight, I'm practically panting. Whatever you want. I'm here. I'm yours. He growls and tries to pull my mouth back to his, but I hold back. Hold still, I buck into him, a slow, punishing rhythm. With every push of my hips, his cock expands until it's pulsing against his jeans. I use his bulge, grinding down hard against it, and the scorching heat radiates up from my pussy and out through my extremities. I claw at his shoulders, riding his captive cock with my covered pussy. The smell of you is driving me wild, he growls. Instead of responding, I increase my pace, desperate to come with him here in this parking lot, claiming him as mine even through our clothes. As my orgasm crests, I latch my mouth onto his, riding him through my convulsions and his. I groan, the sound guttural in my ears, while my fingers grate down his chest and my orgasm rockets through me. A long moment later, I ease up, pushing softly against his now spent dick, and then collapse on him. I nuzzle into his neck, burying my face there. How long has it been since you fed? I ask without pulling back to look at him. Since you. How much longer can you go? He wet his lips. I can taste the sweet syrup of your breath. That's not an answer. A few more days. Drink from me? He cups my face in his hands and forces me to look at him. There's a reason vampires have 4 donors a month. I bite my lip. I know. Are you interviewing any new donors? He brushes his thumb over my lip, releasing it. I should, but I wanted to wait and talk to you about it. I know the last time I brought it up you weren't entirely comfortable, and I want you to be. I need you to be. I smile and kiss him softly. I spoke to Chris about it at length. She was able to put it in perspective. It's who you are, and I accept all parts of you. I trust you, so please, do whatever you need to do. I reach out and brush a sweaty lock of hair off his forehead. He pulls my face back to his and licks the crease of my lips, his tongue flicking between them before planting a hard kiss. I push back into him, biting at his lips and sucking them in, warmth and light filling me up. We make out for a few seconds longer before I hop off and pull down the visor to fix my hair. He gets out of the car and goes around the other side to open mine. Such a gentleman. He extends his hand, and I take it. He walks me through the lot and down the pier to the big top tent. We'll all be watching you. He bends to kiss me again, and our mouths come together like a lock and key. I love you, I whisper. I love you too, Iphigenia. The light of my life. Of all our lives. He squeezes me and lets go. I walk into the tent without looking back, because I know he's standing there, watching me. And if I see the way he's no doubt looking at me, I'll throw tonight's performance to the wind and run to him instead.
Caspian. Reese is waiting on the pier for us, and we all go to confections to pick out a treat for her after her performance. Then we peruse the shops to kill time before the show starts. We haven't lived here long enough to get bored of the pier shops yet, and my camera is always at the ready to catch the glint of the sun off the water, waves playing against the sunlight and sailboats tripping along the surf as they pull into the harbor. How was Iphigenia feeling before you dropped her off? Asked Dom. Reese winks at both of us. Pretty damn good. Dog, I clip his shoulder. At least you'll be relaxed, Dom grins. We make our way inside the big top and take seats a few rows back from the front. We don't want to distract our girl, but we also know it's important for her to know we're here. The lights dim, and the audience hushes. I move forward, excitement sparking through my veins. I've been allowed by the owner, Sirlon, to photograph this particular performance, and I check to make sure I have the correct lens and settings, a constant adjustment. The curtains part to reveal Alexis, the master of ceremonies. I train the lens on her, checking that the aperture and focus are correct in the dim light. Although the circus boasts 2 themes per season,
There are often little differences between each performance to keep the crowds coming back, night after night, weekend after weekend, and Sirlon promised this performance would be particularly photogenic. Dressed in a demure schoolgirl outfit, Alexis stands with her arms raised above her head. When she drops them down in one grand flourish, the house lights click off and darkness descends over the auditorium. We gasp, collectively caught off guard as Alexis's outfit flares to life with patterns and shapes that glow in the dark. Even her makeup lights up her cheeks and freckles. As she walks in a slow circle around the cage, the sound of chains unraveling fills the space. One thick aluminum chain rope drops from the ceiling above us, also lit with the glow-in-the-dark paint. Center stage now, Alexis clutches a link in a chain with one hand and rises as its course is reversed. She wraps the thick links around her middle, then mimes swimming through the air, just a carefree girl out for a swim in a peaceful ocean. But after a moment, her movements turn frantic, as if struggling against a riptide, and then her whole body goes limp, hanging still with her tongue lolling out of her mouth. The audience gasps, and another chain drops with a loud clang. The house lights blaze on again. Suspended at the top of the tent is Iphigenia, her back arched and her whole body spinning in a wide circle, the chain trailing down behind her. A white gossamer tail spreads out behind her tight, one-piece mermaid outfit. A large crown of shells interwoven with pearls perches above her perfect blonde ringlets. The crowd roars, standing and cheering her name. I stand with them, moving into the aisle to snap photos now that there's more light. Iffy performs a flawless routine that simulates being underwater. With every climb, she spreads her arms in a stroke, and with every fall, she holds her legs together while her body spins in tight circles. Our eyes follow her every movement from the top of the chain to the bottom, and then back up again. All at once, Iffy catches sight of schoolgirl Alexis, her inert form still collapsed in the center of the other chain. The distraught mermaid stops her spinning and climbs down toward the other woman. When she reaches Alexis's height, Iffy leaps from her chain to the other, to the audience's audible delight. I click and capture the leap in midair. Down on my little screen, Iffy is perfectly posed even during the leap. When the hell did she find time to practice this routine? She lands just above Alexis and removes her crown of shells, attaching it to the other girl's head. And just like that, the drowned schoolgirl straightens and sparks back to life. Iffy reaches for her hand and the woman grasps hers back. With every movement, Alexis becomes more animated, swimming through the air with renewed vigor. Iffy removes her gossamer tail and, climbing around the other woman, attaches it to Alexis's back. Then, with a tug and some stage magic, the gossamer fabric turns into iridescent scales to match Iffy's own tights. The chain falls away from the lower half of Alexis's body, and her new tail wrapping around her legs in its place. The two women, now both mermaids, spin together, Alexis holding on to Iffy's forearm. Their circle widens, and Iffy swings back to her own chain while Alexis swims away, her chain pulled up into the rafters. Iffy twirls and climbs one last time before performing a dismount that looks like a triple backflip. She sticks to the white stage floor, her arms raised high, and everyone stands to applaud. I snap a few more shots, but before the applause has a chance to die down, ropes descend from the rafters just as the chains did. I freeze with my camera trained on Iffy, surprised they're going directly into the next act. Half a dozen figures, all dressed in black, descend together from the roof. That's when Iffy screams.
Iphigenia. At least I'm alone on the stage when the ghouls descend from the rafters. No time to wonder how they're so agile as they surround me. Really? I'm being attacked on stage again? I had finally worked through all my anxiety from the last time I was attacked during a show. First trackers, now ghouls. Are they sharing a freaking villain playbook? Without a second to waste, I leap back up onto the chain and climb, rung after rung, hauling myself skyward. After my third handhold, one of the ghouls leaps from my legs and catches my feet. But, thank you, Alexis, I'm used to climbing both without the use of my legs, and with dead weight attached. I'm even able to look down and survey the chaotic scene below. My men bellow below me, rushing onto the stage while most of the audience scatters for the exits. Thanks to the Edge's municipal codes, no one is allowed to shift here, but that doesn't stop my men from riding to my rescue. Dominic shouts something at a stagehand, who nods and runs backstage. A moment later, the rigging from all the other acts yet to go tonight drop down from the rafters at once. Dominic and Caspian start yanking down ropes and silk streamers. Why? While Reese barks into his phone. I keep climbing, flinging my legs back and forth. The ghoul tightens its grip on my calves, but it's slipping, and I don't want to be the cause of its death. If I can get it off now, it's only a 15-foot drop, way better than a fall from the catwalk above. So I yank my legs into a half-twist and shoot my body toward the roof. The sheer force of my lunge sends him flying free, and I use the momentum to climb even higher. Sirens flow up the pier. I've never been so happy to be so close to the station. I perch high atop the chain and watch the men fight below. Reese, his phone long gone, is using his moves on the ghouls still coming at him. He ducks, throws out a leg and sweeps it under the closest attacker. The ghoul goes down with a thunk, and Caspian is on top of it with a rope. Reese goes for the next one, who lunges for his throat, hands out. He pivots to the side and the ghoul crashes off the stage and falls into the stands. Dominic jumps off the stage and lands on top of him, wrenching his hands over his head to secure them with a silk cuff. By the time the police arrive, a mere 2 minutes later, my men have disabled and restrained all six ghouls. Still, officers surround them, guns drawn.
Any vampires among the mix?
Chief Sheldon asks Caspian.
Reese?
Cass looks at his cousin, who shakes his head.
No, sir. They're all human.
Guilt steams off Reese in a cloud visible only to me. It's no surprise he made these ghouls himself when he was under the scrim's control. Of course he was able to predict their moves. 30 minutes and one de-ghoulification spell from yours truly later. A troop of officers loads the former ghouls into the back of a police van. They'll be taken to the hospital for a medical checkup, then the station for statements. Sheldon asks to talk to us outside for a minute, and though I'm about to fall over with fatigue from so much physical and magical exertion, I can hardly tell him no.
Why do you think they attacked in the middle of a performance?
He holds a pad of paper in one hand and a pen in the other. Reese growls.
Because they don't have a brain between the six of them.
Sheldon shakes his head.
They're getting bolder for a reason.
Maybe they thought they could grab her quickly, says Caspian. Maybe they wanted an audience when they did so.
Like they were trying to make a statement.
Dominic puts an arm around me.
We can kidnap your people from right under your nose.
Perhaps they had to attack me here. It was one of the first places I warded, so it must be the first place for the spell to wane, if only there was a visible timestamp on magic spells. Or if only I was as powerful as my mother. I chew on my lower lip. The scrim was sending a message to me. He was showing me that I'd better come willingly, or he'll ramp up his efforts to terrorize my entire town. Someone could have been hurt tonight, like Alexis, and it would have been my fault. I can't keep just reacting to the problem. I need to solve it. Time to end this. Time to find my own way into Bray. Reese puts an arm around my other shoulder, and Caspian stands behind me, wending his arms around my waist. Sheldon looks up from his notepad and makes eye contact with each of the guys.
Take care of her.
We will,
they reply in unison, and then pivot to walk me back to the tent so I can change and grab my stuff.
Caspian. At home, Iphigenia lets out a heavy sigh. She drops on the couch with Reese on her left. Dom sits on the floor by her feet, looking up at her and using his most soothing psychologist voice. It used to irk the hell out of me, but I've grown to appreciate it, especially in moments like these when it's calming our girl. We'll figure this out together. Dom's hands rest on her knees. There's no reason to go at it by yourself. We want to help, I call from the kitchen, where I'm making Iffy some much-needed herbal tea. Please, let us, Reese says. I hand her the warm mug and sit on her right.
I'd almost forgotten she was attacked during a circus performance once, long before any of us knew her. Her silks were cut by terrorists, and she tumbled many feet to the ground and broke a leg. It took her months to recover, and another year before she was comfortable performing again. Then tonight happened. All of that progress destroyed like a burnt-up Polaroid. If anyone can help her get past it, Dominic can. She clutches her tea in both hands and smiles at me, but it's perfunctory and doesn't reach those cerulean eyes. Eyes that currently remind me of sea glass caught in the tumble of an ocean tsunami. Pink suffuses her cheeks as she breathes in the steam rising from the cup, her perfect nose turned up, her blonde curls falling in mismatched lengths. Post-performance hair. I want to take her face in my hands and kiss her cheeks, her eyes, her perfect little nose, and push back her fear with pleasure. There's a knock on the door and we all startle. Dom pushes himself up, but the knob turns, and a wild-eyed Nolan bursts inside. "Thorn!" he screams. The rest of us jump to our feet. Dominic approaches the crazed vamp, his hands held out. "What's wrong?" "He took Thorn!" Nolan's gaze swings between us, his eyes bloodshot and raw. "Who took Thorn?" asks Dominic. "The Scrim!" Iphigenia's mouth opens and closes like a fish out of water. The mug crashes to the floor, tea splashing everywhere. Her eyes close and squeeze shut like she's trying to shut out the world. After everything she's been through tonight, and now this too? I pick up the mug, still whole, and drop it on the coffee table. Then I put my arm around her, pulling her into me. She leans her head against me, which only exacerbates the sound of her heart thumping wildly in her chest. Dominic holds his hands out. "One thing at a time, Nolan, please." His calming timbre works on me and Iphigenia, too. Her heartbeat slows a fraction, and she lets out a tiny mew. "Where and when?" Nolan runs his hands through his hair. "It's my fault. I couldn't stop him." Rhys puts his arm around his brother's shoulders. "Hey, man, whatever happened, there was nothing you could have done. But who is the Scrim?" It's Iffy who responds, though she doesn't pull away from my chest to do it. Her voice, muffled.
"No one knows exactly, but he's evil. He lives in some other dimension. He tried to kidnap Sadie once years ago. My father gave his life to banish him to his home world."
She stops talking for a moment, and I squeeze her closer still, trying to share my strength with her. How hard it must be for her to dredge up these memories.
"He must be the puppet master, the one making all the ghouls here on Earth to do his bidding. I guess it was too much of a coincidence for there to be two powerful bad guys attacking the Edge. But why? Why is he back? And why now? And why hasn't he tried to go after Sadie again?"
"Let's go and ask him," I snarl. "Where did this occur? Maybe the portal is still open." Nolan shakes his head.
"It happened hours ago, I think. I must have passed out afterward. It was on the beach. The portal was over the water, and I dove into the surf to try and grab Thorn, but then... nothing. I just came to in the sand, dry, like the tide had gone out while I was unconscious. I got here as fast as I could."
"But..."
If he looks around me at Nolan.
"Are you sure?"
"I don't know any other giant, bald, shark-toothed monster that can open a portal and drag someone inside of it, do you?"
His voice is shaking. "Hey now." Rhys squeezes his shoulder. "No need to get snarky. I'm sorry. I'm frustrated and pissed at myself," Nolan growls. Iffy untangles herself from me and rushes up the ladder to the loft.
"I'm changing into something more utilitarian," she calls down.
"Sit down while Iffy dresses." Dominic motions to a stool. "Let me get you some coffee." Rhys stirs his brother to a seat. "Poor Nolan. He's been through far too much in the past couple of years, and he's always looked up to Thorn. God, Thorn! How can he be gone? Witnessing the Scrim take our pack leader would mess any of us up. Just hearing about it after the fact cuts me to the core. And yet, of all of us, Thorn has the best chance of coming out on top against that monster. Cass, fill some water bottles and throw some snacks into the backpack in case we need anything," Dominic says. I open the hall closet and grab a day pack, filling it with supplies. Water bottles, jerky, trail mix, a coil of rope, a hefty utility knife, a first aid kit. You never know. We'll stop off at Thorne's on the way to grab his gun belt too, so we have at least one gun and a can of mace. "What's the plan?" I ask. "Nolan, can you bring us to the exact spot where Thorn was taken?" asks Reese.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?